Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Well, so we are going to begin studying this book that you don't have yet. The books have been ordered. We have a tracking number. There is some kind of delay in getting them to us. So,
were they in the canal?
I hope they didn't come via the canal. Yeah. I don't know where they print these, but the publisher's based in Minneapolis. It doesn't tell us where it got printed, but I'm guessing, yeah, I'm guessing not India. But we have ordered your books via Beaverdale Books, your local bookstores. And so there was a delay in the shipping, and then we have dropped a line to them, and we will expect to hear back from them tomorrow as to kind of the status. So you should have gotten by email the introduction. Talking about these strange sights that that we are invited to spend some time noticing. So so I've attempted, again, I'm workshopping this material for a class that I'm teaching at Synod School on the same book. So I'm workshopping this a little with you, and part of my intention is to be able to teach this regardless of whether the folks have read the book. So even if you did not read the introduction, you still qualify for being here. And in fact, you are very important. I'm going to start each evening with sort of a taste of the kind of enchantment we'll be talking about. on that evening. And we're going to talk about liturgical enchantment later on. And so I'm going to begin with the service of the light from the evening prayer in our Presbyterian Book of Common Worship daily prayer. So I'm going to say some words. You will know how to respond at a couple of points, but we're just going to acknowledge right now that it is evening. Friends, may the Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Let us give thanks to the Lord our God.
It is right. Thank you. I to do this.
Blessed are you, O Lord, Redeemer God. You destroyed the bonds of death, and from the darkness of the tomb drew forth the light of the world. You led us through the waters of death and made us children of light, singing alleluias and dancing to the music of new life. Pour out your spirit upon us, that dreams and visions bring us ever closer to the kingdom of Jesus Christ, our risen Savior. Through him and in the Holy Spirit, all glory be to you, Almighty God, this night, forever and ever. Amen. The light of Christ shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Amen. That was just a little snippet of the larger service of evening prayer, which is one of the liturgies that it's offered to us for Hallowing time. We'll talk about Hallowing. But first, I'm going to start one of the ways that I account for people may or may not have done the reading is that I read to them. So here from the introduction, we were hunting for magic eels. That's an odd opening for a conversation about revitalizing Christian faith in our secular skeptical age, but stay with me. The magic eels, or to be more precise, the legend concerning them, are from Wales, where we were on holiday with our dear friend Hannah. We were visiting Llandwyn Island, exploring the ruins of the abbey associated with St. Dwynwen. St. Dwynwen was a 5th century Celtic saint and is the patron saint of lovers in Wales. Celebrated on January 25th, St. Dwynwen's Day is the Welsh version of St. Valentine's Day. Llandwyn Island was a famous site of pilgrimage because of its holy well. Inhabiting the well were enchanted eels that could predict your romantic future. According to the legend, if the eels disturbed a token thrown into the well, your lover would be faithful for life. Not surprisingly, the church became very wealthy due to all the pilgrimages. Who needs premarital counseling when you've got magic eels? Pilgrimages to Llandwyn Island began to decline after the Protestant Reformation. Today, St. Dwynwen's church is a ruin. And sadly, there is no longer a well with magic eels. Things have changed a lot over the last 500 years. I want to talk about these changes and their impact on faith in a world increasingly dominated by skepticism, doubt, and disbelief. We don't make pilgrimages to holy wells anymore to pray for our marriages. A world stuffed with supernatural wonders seems to be a thing of the past. Our world is secular, skeptical, and scientific. 500 years ago, life was enchanted. God existed, and the devil was real. The world teemed with angels and demons. There were magical creatures and dark occult forces. It was a world of holy wells and magic eels. But with the Protestant Reformation and the beginning of the Enlightenment, the world, in the West at least, has grown increasingly disenchanted. We live in a world dominated by science and technology. Increasing numbers of us don't believe in God anymore, to say nothing about believing in the devil or angels. We don't expect miracles. We know that stage magicians aren't sorcerers. I'm looking at you, Bruce. That there's a rational explanation behind their tricks and illusions. The world of St. Dwynwen is viewed as quirky and quaint, but also naive and superstitious. We've grown up and left those fairy tales behind. Rates of agnosticism and atheism in the United States have been steadily, if slowly, increasing, especially among the young and college educated. There's also the rise of the nuns, people who no longer formally identify with any religious tradition. Our public sphere is increasingly described as secular and post-Christian. So that's your contemporary issues tie-in, right? Because I promised that this would have relevance today, that this is not just spiritual, right? Like this is current events going on. Bev.
His book was just published, correct?
March 23rd.
That's okay. Okay. So he is really on top of it with this.
That's right.
Yeah. Good. Good.
Yeah. So, and he has written a number of other books so he is a psychology professor. Richard Beck is a psychology professor. But his books, at least his popular books, he probably writes psychology journal articles, and those aren't popular. But his books and his blog are all about faith. His blog is titled Experimental Theology.
Ooh.
Experimental Theology. He writes about the way that faith happens in our lives and our world today. And and does that with a psychologist's mind, right? A psychologist's training. So he'll talk about neuroscience, and he'll talk about the ways that that we recognize, are you one of us or are you not one of us? He's got a whole book on that. But he's doing this all as a committed Christian. So Abilene Christian is a Churches of Christ school, and Richard is a member of the Churches of Christ, which are a very, I think I even was planning on saying this, but here we are. It's a very, very sort of low church tradition, very, you know, none of this crazy liturgy stuff. And if it doesn't say in the New Testament that this is how you should worship, this is not how you should worship. And so for him to write this book about enchantment places him at a really interesting place in his church tradition, which, you know, obviously believes that God exists, right? But the ways that he's thinking about this as a progressive academic living in the religious tradition in which he is very happy to live. He belongs in this tradition and can tell you why. But he always fits kind of awkwardly in the places where he fits, which is something I really enjoy about him. So here he is on pilgrimage to an enchanted well, a holy well in Wales. And we'll talk about why he's going to use the word enchanted, but he's visiting this holy well hunting for magic eels. And he acknowledges that the way that we, as sort of modern people, the way that we think about these medieval holy sites really points to the way that we are so disenchanted, because we know what science is, right? And I've been like drumming on that for 13 months now, right? We believe in science. We follow the science as our way of following Jesus, right? But how does science work? How did we get a COVID vaccine on such short order? Through skepticism, through testing, okay, what happened versus what did we expect to happen? And that process does amazing things. But when we live in such a scientific skeptical world, then we often also find that religion no longer is kind of this magical core to everything. It's this thing that happens either in the space that we can't figure out, and so it gets smaller and smaller and smaller because science is really good at figuring things out, or it functions as morality and politics. It's about being a good person. And your political alignment might change the way you would describe what it means to be a good person, but kind of regardless of politics, we find ourselves disenchanting the world in that same way. So meantime, there are generations rising now who have sort of lived through the end of this disenchantment, have come of age in this increasingly post-Christian world. And they say, if all this is about is being a good person, I can be a really good person by, you know, not bothering with this whole God thing. And by the way, churches have a terrible track record of doing awful things to people because of all this stuff they believe, right? So there's this rising generation that says, I don't know that church is where I'm going to look for finding good people. And at the same time are saying, I'm really tired of the world being so disenchanted. These deep religious traditions have some resources that I can mine in order to figure out how to not just be a good person. I already know that, but how to be a person in a world that is about something bigger than me. So that's where you get, for instance, when we talked about the nuns and nuns, right? And so so these religious nuns and these religious nuns are finding each other and saying, hang on a second, you've got something to teach us because you are the custodians of this spiritual tradition. Richard Beck is also a psychology professor, and so and a psychology professor who works with undergrads. And so he cares a lot about students of that, you know, that sort of magical college age. And he says, I notice about these students that they are more and more unhappy and anxious, and not because they've made bad choices. But he says, I think it's connected to the fact that we have disenchanted the world, that we can explain everything in the world. And so all of this, you know, all of this, we have magic eels that we have thrown out means that we don't quite know where to look for God anymore. And so he finds this, this discomfort of what people are missing, identifies that with that, that's where we could have been looking for God, but we're not anymore, in language that we can make sense of. We're going to loop back to a lot of these over the coming weeks. But he also is going to say that it's not necessarily the case that enchantment is completely dead, because people are still looking for and finding kind of their own spiritual paths. There's kind of a do-it-yourself approach to this now, kind of looking for that sense of what's more out there? What's the thing that religion has so well sort of organized and filed away that we don't have to think about what that more is when we're in these religious spaces, but that more is still out there. So there is still kind of this search for, there's something there. That's something that that he says is like, he quotes Dante, who talks about seeing the love that moves the sun and the other stars. The love that moves the sun and the other stars. And we'll talk next week about, I mean, we all know that gravity moves the sun and the other stars, right? And like they got their first kaboom from the Big Bang, and then everything's just been happening. What would it look like to see the love that moves the sun and the other stars? I'm going to give you just one more little piece here, and then I'm going to give you a chance to kind of chew and swallow. So I said that we're going to talk about enchantment, we're talking about disenchantment and enchantment as opposed to talking about skepticism and belief. He doesn't really want to spend a lot of time with the idea of belief. Because belief, as we sort of conventionally think about it, belief is about, I have intellectually decided to agree with some doctrinal propositions, right? So God exists, Jesus is God incarnate, you know, he was born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, died, and was buried. He descended into hell, and on the third day, he rose again from the dead, right? Like, that's doctrine. And that can be claimed without really having it make a difference to you, without having it really be a part of your lived experience. I can just, up in my brain, think about that and decide, okay, yeah, that sounds right. Or I can say up in my head, well, that doesn't quite make sense, but yeah, you know, like it makes me feel all warm and fuzzy inside. So it's got to be right. It doesn't really matter if it's not real, right? It makes me feel warm and fuzzy inside when we sing those songs. So that's belief, right? Either head belief or emotion, right? But he's going to say that experience exists prior to belief. Experience drives our belief. So belief is how we make sense of our experience. And then he says, demanding belief without experience is asking people to believe in nothing. Demanding belief without experience. If I can't invite you into an experience of God, but I want to convince you that God exists, what does that even mean? So that experience is what enchantment is about. It's about noticing that God is right there in front of us. So I'm going to make that as a theological claim, that God is there in front of us. And enchantment is about noticing that, about noticing what's already there. And then we will, at the very end, we will talk about the way that enchantment is not just, is not neutral. Enchantment is not good all by itself. It's not bad all by itself. But rather, our experience is actually shaped by the ways that we focus our attention. So we'll talk about discernment at the end there too. So that's your like quickie outline of the next few weeks. I want to invite everybody, because I did just throw so much at you, I want to invite everybody to just sort of soak that in for a minute. And so we're just going to take a quick little minute of silence. Maybe notice what you heard that interested you. Maybe notice any questions that have come up for you. You could write down questions that have come up for you, but that was a whole bunch of stuff all at once. So just let that sit with you for a second. Okay. And I will have another, we're going to talk a little bit about liturgy in just a minute as well, because we're going to talk about some of these different modes of enchantment as we go along. But I want to invite any questions or observations that landed with you during that first little barrage of information. Bev.
The part, I have two questions. One question, one observation. Enchantment and disenchantment is belief versus, what was the other word he used? Well, there was a technical word that you...
So there was belief and skepticism.
Skepticism, that's it. Thanks.
Yeah, and Beck would like us to not imagine that enchantment and belief are the same thing and disenchantment and skepticism are the same thing.
Right.
But, and part of that is because of the way that we can have belief without enchantment, mm-hmm. right? We can have right doctrine without having an experiential encounter with God. So, so he doesn't want us to necessarily line those things up. He wants us to really focus on enchantment as this, this focusing our attention on the reality that God is already present in the world.
Right.
So, and I suppose, you know, that sort of presupposes belief. In order to talk about this in a, you know, in specific Christian terms, we have to agree on some Christian language. But I don't think it necessarily means that you've got to have this specific language. We're just going to use that language because that's what we can make sense of.
What you were just describing, Nathan, sounds to me like a definition of faith. am I missing the point here, or is that the word we're trying not to use? Let me go a little bit further.
I would faith. Say, okay, sorry, go ahead.
Faith to me, and I haven't written any theses on this lately, seems to be believing in something that you can still be skeptical of, or that you may be skeptical of. I don't know how all this stuff works. I don't know why it works. I've decided to have faith or belief, or maybe that's enchantment.
So I don't know specifically why Beck chose to use enchantment rather than the word faith. I don't recall within the book that he goes into details about that. I think most of the time in sort of common parlance, I think faith and belief are used so interchangeably that the sort of technical distinction that you just drew for us wouldn't necessarily hold over the course of a book. And so by using a weirder term, enchantment, I think he's trying to get us out of that, you know, do I think that's real or not? I think he's actually going to invite us to pay less attention to the, you know, do I think that's real or not is a skeptical question. And he's going to invite us to be less skeptical for a specific reason. You know, skepticism does really good things in science. It can even help refine the ways that we talk about our religious experience. But he wants us to talk about our religious experience, not about what do we think is true about God. We'll get to that in the discernment, but the experience needs to be there, right? And we can avoid the experience if we're just talking about, you know, is this my faith or not? Bev.
The enchantment, I think, is more of an emotion-driven word. Call it flowery, call it soft, call it, I mean, that's when we hear that word enchantment. It's not necessarily the truth, but is religion a truth to begin with? But the enchantment part, I like the faith, I like the belief. Those are much stronger words to me than enchantment.
Okay, yeah.
And so, go ahead.
Yeah, so I would say that I'll own this for myself, and then I will also try to foist it off on our author. So I will own for myself that that I am as suspicious of emotions as I am of intellectual stuff. So this way that we have said, oh, there's all of our thinking stuff, but then there's emotion. I think it is probably true psychologically that our emotional reactions are in the driver's seat, and our intellectual reasoning is all about just making sense of what our heart already did, right? But I'm real suspicious of our hearts too, because I think they can be tricked. In the same way that our brains can be tricked, really both of them can be sort of, you know, can turn their attention away from God. And when we talk about enchantment, really the faculty that you should think of is attention. So that could be, you know, that could be connecting with you emotionally. It could be connecting with you intellectually. It could be connecting with you physically. but we're not talking about something so much strictly internal to you as what's going on in your brain or what's going on in your heart, which is also going on in your brain, because we point here for emotions, but it's all happening up here, just down here in our amygdala, right? So, and again, you know, we've got all the neuroscience you could want here too. So, but we're going to talk about attention, and we'll actually talk more specifically about attention next week. So the book falls into four parts, and we're going to cover these four parts of the book. We're going to take like 5 weeks to cover three of the parts, and the other part is going to stretch across those weeks. We are on part zero tonight, and getting just kind of a quick overview of the book and of the ideas that we're dealing with here. Part one that we'll look at next week really is gonna invite us to look at disenchantment as a problem, not about belief. It's not that we, the Christian church, have quit believing in God, right? It is that we have quit paying attention to God. So it's not that our brains don't think God is there. It's not that we don't have, you know, wonderful emotive experiences in worship, but we've quit paying attention to where God is. So that's what he's going to mean by enchantment, is about where is our attention. Part two of the book looks at what would an enchanted Christianity mean? What would it look like for Christianity to be enchanted? Part three, this is the one that we're going to spread across the weeks, because he's going to talk about four specific kind of modes of enchantment, ways of continuing to enchant the world. And so we're going to stretch those out and kind of take one each week, which is what I'll talk about in just a second with liturgy. And then we're going to talk about discernment, kind of, you know, what spirits are we actually paying attention to here? So we're going to fit that into these weeks by having a different enchantment practice each day. So today's was liturgical. And then we'll talk about kind of one part of the book each week. And I'll recommend a given chapter for you to read. So Bruce has a question.
I'm still wondering why he threw eels in this book. Is this...
It's a hook, isn't it?
We're gonna things. Does it have anything to do with the rest of the book?
Every so often he'll kind of slap you with an eel again. So he was always gonna open the book with that story. And so I found as part of his sort of book rollout, he was on one of his favorite podcasts. And so the question came up, okay, why is this called Hunting Magic Eels? Was that your call? And he said, no, actually that was the publisher's decision. And so he made sure to kind of bring the eels a little bit more into this. But that story of, you know, here he is, a perfectly sane, rational person who knows what science is and practices it every day, is at this holy well in Wales, hunting magic eels that he kind of knows are not strictly speaking there in a factual sense, right? But the fact that that this sort of exploration to go and see if he can notice the magic eels actually is part of what makes this holy place, makes the holiness shine through. So it's about what it does to your attention, you know, which is, my understanding is that has a lot to do with stage magic too, right? That it's about directing somebody's attention and you know, if you're working really hard at not being interested in this magic show, it doesn't do anything for you, right? because you're not invested in this thing actually happening or this impossible thing not happening, but it looks like it wants to. So again, this is going to be about attention. Oh, Bev, you muted yourself and then started talking.
Sorry, I didn't realize we were still on. This did happen in Ireland, right? I mean, isn't that where the magic eels were?
This one was in Wales.
Oh, Wales. Same type of place.
They drove out the snakes later.
That was in Ireland.
Oh, gosh.
Right.
Yeah.
That was St. Patrick, wasn't it?
Clever.
It's just such a land of strange stories.
There are some amazing stories. And actually, one of our fourth mode of enchantment is going to be Celtic enchantment.
Oh.
That is wrapped up in these stories of you know, strange holy places and the way that God is present in these natural elements around us, and that the whole bunch of other stuff is present in these natural elements around us too. So we get to talk about that in a few weeks. I want to talk about liturgy for just a bit this evening. Are you ready? This is great. Okay. So I told you about the Church of Christ, right? It is this very non-liturgical Protestant church. We don't do crazy, weird ritual things because Paul never told us to do crazy, weird ritual things in the New Testament, right? A branch of this this tradition, the Churches of Christ, does not have musical instruments in worship because they are never mentioned in the New Testament. They are mentioned in the Psalms. The Psalms are not in the New Testament. You can sing the Psalms. You can sing the words harp and lyre, but you may not play one because they're not in the New Testament. So this is the sort of impulse of this worship tradition, in which Richard Beck grew up and still belongs. He went to Catholic school. And so next week, I will give you the reading of what happened the first time he went to the Ash Wednesday service. Poor little Church of Christ kid at Catholic middle school. It was completely unfamiliar. He had no idea what was going on, right? It is now his favorite service in the entire church year. So it gets better. But what he actually learned in Catholic school, he learned other things in Catholic school, but the thing he learned was the Stations of the Cross. And the Stations of the Cross are this, you know, this 14-point meditative journey through Jesus' final day. And they had to do this every Friday during Lent. And the Stations of the Cross doesn't resolve, right? You go through the whole thing and then Jesus dies and then they put him in the tomb. That's your last station. And he found when he went to college and did not go to a Catholic college, it was the first time for years that he had not practiced Lent. He had not practiced the Stations of the Cross. And somebody said, oh yeah, tomorrow's Easter. And he's like, whoa, I'm not ready. I haven't gotten ready for Easter. I haven't practiced this season of preparation without resolution. Right? We love resolution, right? Like that's one of the things that makes me suspicious of emotions, because our emotions love when we get to the final suspended chord resolves into this big grand major thing. And you're just like, oh, lovely. Good symphony. Right. But the Stations of the Cross don't do that. Right? They stay in this weird minor key the entire time and they never quite resolve until Easter Sunday and you can say Alleluia again. So he said, this worked on me for years. I didn't realize it was working on me, but I practiced this liturgy for years, and I didn't realize until later what it was doing. And what it was doing was creating in him the, not only, not just the need to, but the ability to spend time with what's not resolved yet, to spend time with, you know, lament and sorrow and confusion, to spend time before we get to Easter. And that's what liturgy, does. It marks time, and it marks space. So so he says that these liturgical traditions, and his primary sort of taproot into liturgy is through the Roman Catholic tradition. The Eastern Orthodox traditions have their own flavor of liturgy that is just as sort of bound to enchanting the space and time in which they take place. But he says that the primary insight that he takes from the Catholic tradition is that matter matters. Matter matters. He says, grace comes to us through the physical world. And that's in contrast to this Protestant tendency to draw this really bright line between the material world and the spiritual world, right? And we're not superstitious, and there's, you know, there's this is stuff and this is spiritual, and they're not the same thing. Which is sort of an important insight by itself, but he said, if we do that, and that's the only way we think about it, if we do that for too long, we start to think that this material stuff over here is what's real. And this spiritual stuff over here, that's not real, right? You know, when you are first learning, you know, the difference between fiction and nonfiction, right? You know, and nonfiction is true, which means that fiction is false. Only that's not what fiction and nonfiction mean, right? That's not what material and spiritual mean either. But rather the, you know, maybe material and spiritual are distinct realities, but they kind of shoot through each other. The spiritual reality is there within the material reality. And that's part of what it means to say that matter matters. He says, if matter matters, then beauty matters too. Beauty matters by prompting us to wonder and awe and that sense of transcendence that, you know, we are talking about something that's bigger than just the stuff, but it's revealed to us in the stuff. So he talks about enchanting space and enchanting time. He says, my office, I, Richard Beck, you know, progressive academic psychology professor, at a low church school, my office is filled with icons and crucifixes and candles and statues of saints who inspire me. I've got a prayer kneeler in the corner. I have enchanted my space. I can't go to work without being reminded of spiritual realities. So his space is filled with these material things that point to the spiritual reality that he's in. And we got into this by talking about enchanting time. So enchanting time through the liturgical calendar and the seasons of the church. And so, so the service of the light from evening prayer, the long prayer that I said is different because now it's Easter. It was a different prayer back in Lent, and now it's Easter, and we say different things. We remember different parts of the story. So that, you know, Walking the stations of the cross on Fridays during Lent was part of preparing him in time for Easter, part of allowing time to reveal who God is. In the same way, he said, you know, Advent kind of reclaims the Christmas season, because the Christmas season is the 12 days beginning on Christmas Eve, right? And so he says what that does for him, among other things, is that it actually sets up a wall against the consumerization of Christmas, right? And the consumerization of Christmas is one of those things where it's actually super disenchanting, right? Because, I have to buy all these stupid things for my, and they're not even going to like it. And I have to go out on Black Friday and it's going to be 4 a.m. and we're all going to trample each other looking for a stupid TV. And we bought all of this stuff. And now, you know, people in China are eating toxic poison because they had to make this thing so that I could give it to somebody. Stupid Christmas, right? And not that that doesn't happen when you observe Advent, but Advent says, ho, 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 whoa, hang on a second. We need to spend time just being uncomfortable with a world that does not have the incarnate Christ in it, so that we recognize, we attend to what that means when he shows up. So that's, those are things that these liturgical enchantments do, is they fix our space and our time as ways of attending to who God is. And again, kind of notice how that attention is a matter not of do I think it, do I feel it, but what do I notice? So I want to give you another minute to chew and swallow. Notice what you heard that was interesting. Notice what questions came up for you. And just allow this little bit to soak in. Okay, what do you notice?
I've got a couple of things I need to kind of throw out and see how the rest of you, if you're thinking along with me or whether I'm out here in left field. On the very, or page 14, he says that disenchantment isn't a myth. It's a huge and growing force in Europe and America. So that was kind of refreshing to me that this is just not an American situation. And I guess if you look at those two areas, that's some of the more advanced economies, some of the more advanced standard of living and all that. But I love Western Europe. And tourists spend more time in cathedrals than members of the city. And I have a good Italian friend that lives in Turin, and you know, he makes no bones about it. They just, church attendance is down. And I think it's the same way probably in France, but these wonderful big cathedrals, and they see tourists go in them more than anybody else. Okay. Another thing, and I read this 2 years ago, as opposed to April of 2019 instead of 2000, it would have had different meaning to me. I mean, I got my I love highlighters. I just, when I read and something about highlighting, but it's just answering some questions for me. I think the word ache and disenchantment, or enchantment, but especially disenchantment, are just hitting the nail on the head. I've had an ache for like 15 months. And I, you know, I had pretty smooth sailing as a youngster. Each decade, you know, the decade of the 50s, I had a great time. The 60s, I was 45 when my dad died. So up my first 45 years, I had pretty smooth sailing. And as we all know, there's peaks and valleys in your life. And so I was spared too many of those early on, but oh, in the next 30 years, all that pent up, what you say, challenges caught up with me. And I like to think that I've had enough psychology and enough lifetime experiences that I can take care of Warren's psychological situation or mental concerns. You know, I don't need to go to an outside counselor. I think I can take care of myself, if you will. Now, an asterisk. I did tell my daughter, and this was probably last fall when I was really kind of in a situation I had never been in, you know, that I says to her, I says, now, if you think your dad is needing some outside professional help, you be sure and tell me. And just to give you an example, and I think it was in the fall, I was still golfing, and Bruce, you might have, did we lose Bruce? No, there's Bruce. I was riding with Lee Cox in a golf cart paired up, and just kind of out of the blue, Lee just kind of looked over and says, Warren, are you doing okay? What is it that I am projecting that Lee would have asked me that question? And of course, you know my answer. Oh, yeah, I'm fine. No, I'm, yeah, but Lee Cox, pretty perceptive, and I think he is a shepherd or was at one time. But I identify that ache, and I'm trying to, and I can explain it. I can explain it, but I'm also trying to prescribe how I deal with it. And then the facts are I lost a very good friend in November of 18. I lost a real close friend. I mean, known like almost a confidant for 45 years in October of this year of 20. Haven't had my every 7-day opportunity to socialize with you folks. And I think Nathan's probably said to me, going to church is like winding my 7-day clock, you know. And I'm getting the vibes and I'm getting the reassurances. And then, like I say, as each decade has gone by, I've lost wonderful support, be the immediate family, extended family, now good friends. And I'm at an age now, see, where I have fewer and fewer, I shouldn't say that, I have fewer longtime friends that used to kind of pull me out of my doldrums or pull me or get me back on track. And like I say, this page 7 and page 8, wow, that I'm just, I said, whoa, he's just talking about, you know, things that, for example, anxiety, depression, addiction, loneliness and suicide are all on the rise. Whoa. Somebody else is saying that, you know, that's kind of happening. And this is, like I say, just published in March of this year. This is not a 10-year-old volume. And like I say, I might admit to having had some anxiety that surprised me, that it snuck up on me and got me. I don't think depression's too strong a word. I think I'll admit to having anxiety that never, it didn't last. If it found me, it was usually over a specific situation and went away. But then again, it's a combination of the times are so different in the decade we're living in now. And I'm dealing with it at at age 77, as opposed to the decade I was living in when I was in my 30s or even my 40s. And I was able to cope. Sure, you know, maybe an occasional bruise, but I mean, I had pretty smooth sailing. And then all of a sudden, as the decades become more complicated or more issues and maybe too much TV news, maybe I ought to cut that back. And then my ability to, without my call a friend when I'm kind of down, losing those real supportive contacts, I got to be careful that like, say my daughter doesn't say, Dad, I think it's time. Maybe you aren't on top of it. So she's my watch person, that if she comes to me and says, then, but other than that, I'm going to tough it out, and by gosh, I'm going to, and this will be in the rearview mirror.
So in the section that we're going to talk about next week, this first part of the book looks at this, he calls it attention blindness. And I'm going to invite you to read the first chapter, which is, he titles it, The Slow Death of God. But Warren, there's a whole chapter on the ache.
Good.
And that the mental health just erosion that that he identifies with this disenchantment. And something I appreciate about the way that he talks about it is that he is also, again, a practicing academic psychologist who understands that mental illness as a clinical thing exists. And so he tries to, whether he's successful at this is probably a question for sort of analysis of the book, but he tries to sort of differentiate a little bit between the, you know, the, I need clinical support in the form of, you know, of therapy, of medication, and the like, sort of differentiates between that and the ways that we use this mental health language, the language of anxiety and depression, to describe something else is wrong. You know, and as you described in your own attentiveness to your own experience, part of what was wrong was that your friends are dying. And so there's a gap there. There's an empty spot there. And so the next question in terms of hallowing that that experience is to say, what is it of God that I was finding in these relationships with these folks? And so what is it of God that I have lost this particular way of seeing, this particular way of experiencing, which doesn't mean that God's not there, right? Mm-hmm. But that God had been expressing himself in this particular relationship, in this particular way. And now, because that relationship and that person is no longer there, you've got kind of this outline of, oh, I see a little bit more of who God is. And probably God is showing up somewhere else as well, but don't leap to that resolution too fast either, right? Like, walk the stations of the cross.
Done that.
Yeah. Yeah, you've walked the original stations of the cross.
Yes. But I'm just curious of those of you, you know, we have a pretty good relationship. Have you had a time, maybe a couple weeks span or a month span in the last 15 months, where you're beginning to wonder, what am I going through, or what am I needing, or what am I missing? Have you also experienced that? I would like to think I'm not Lone Ranger and unique.
No, and my sister-in-law had a panic attack last week. She's a lawyer. She's been working from home, and they did discover a heart condition, but she thought she was having a heart attack, so she panicked literally and ended up going through all her hands trembling, her heart racing, hyperventilating, crying, everything. And when the paramedics came to help her, they told her, all we do is answer calls of people having panic attacks.
Really?
Social anxiety is huge when you start to leave your house again. And we have all taken a mental toll of going through this pandemic and the staying home and the not seeing people that we used to do daily. Even if it was the cashier at Fairway, we saw them more often than we have in the last 15 months. And it's taken a toll on all of us mentally. And God, it's taken a toll on faith in God, because this stuff just keeps coming at us. And I turn 60 next week, and all of my younger friends are joking with me and saying, oh, you're going to be 60. You're the first one of us to turn 60. And oh my goodness, Deb. And all I can think of in my head is, well, the 50s weren't so great, so I'm hoping the 60s are a little better.
And every decade gets better, Deb.
There you go. I'm hoping the 60s are going to be very different than the 50s were.
You're the baby of this group then, huh?
Yes, she is.
I've got lots of faith. Yeah.
Yes.
So, but we've all felt that, and describing it as an ache, when I read that, I thought that's perfect.
That's the that right word. Perfect.
Yeah. Ache. Yeah.
I got.
So no, you're not alone.
Warren, I got your back. You and I are in the golf group, and you're in the geezer group. I got a geezer group across America where they send me humor every day, and I send it out to you, and
yeah,
that ought to give you some.
I do read them. Yeah,
humor is the best of medicine. That's what Reader's Digest says.
You know, Deb, when you mentioned your sister-in-law and that she's working from home, and of course everybody's working from home these days, right? Except the people who can't. But actually, a piece of what has been really, it's been here for me the whole time, but has been, it's getting sharper for me, is the fact that I'm working from home. And I think something about, as you were describing that situation in the context of this, of the ache, it's not for me just that there's no, you know, there's no differentiation between when I'm at work and when I'm not, which like that's hard and stressful and frustrating, just from a practical standpoint. There are, it's that enchantment of space that it's not like being home is more or less holy than being at work, right? Like I'm a good Reformed Protestant, but they're different, and I am different in those two contexts, not because like I'm putting on airs in one place or the other, but because that transition process changes my attention, right? I notice where I am. And this has always been true about me, you know, doing work. You know, I was in college, I could never do my classwork in my dorm room. I always had to go to the library or one of the academic buildings to do my homework because I needed to be in the place where that happens. And it's not like I'm illiterate when I get home, but I can't, it's not that I can't even, it's that I don't, the attention, it's a hallowing thing. So he's going to use the word hallowing as sort of a synonym for enchanting. And it's from, you know, it's from the Lord's Prayer, right? You know, our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. So hallowed, set apart, made holy, right? Made holy. And so that's another way to think about when we use this word enchanted. You could use the word hallowed. And it's not like we create the holiness, right? Like the holiness is already there. God is already present. What we're doing is noticing it. And there are all kinds of things that for me hallow, whether I'm at church or whether I'm at home. I'm at work either way most of the time, right? But it's a different way of being attentive. And I can be a little bit less at work when I'm at home if I have come from somewhere. Maybe that's hallowing. Maybe that's enchanting.
Well, just one more comment. As you all know, I'm a volunteer driver for LifeServe Blood Center. And when this all broke out, you know, on essentials, if you weren't essential, stay home or whatever the heck it was, delivery of blood and collecting blood from remote sites is a necessary thing. So I had a little document that the blood center put out that if anybody questioned what I was doing, which, you know, when you got on the side of your van, LifeServe Blood Center, it's pretty obvious. But if I had not had that in the last 15 months, I think I'd have really been struggling. And I want you to know, we got a good donor here in Nathan. I've ran across him at least two or three times when I'm going out to the blood donor center on Hickman by Living History Farm. And he probably sees I'm a pretty happy guy when I'm out. And Claudia understands, you know, that we need to be away. So she's as happy that I'm gone, trust me, probably as I am. But anyway, that was my life-saving activity. And I mean, truly, I could drive 7 days a week if I wanted to. But if I had not had that out during these last 15 months, whoa, I don't know. I don't, and everybody's got their way of coping. But boy, that was a benefit to me that I was able to get up, get going, and didn't have anybody giving me that, you know, why aren't you at home? And I didn't have any of that, but it really, like I say, I thought, what would I have done without my hours of driving?
We can call that a blessing.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
Both ways.
Yeah. Claudia would second the motion. You know, she still has not forgiven me for retiring. 17 years later. Yeah, she still is not good. Yeah, May of 04. It'll be 17 years in May.
Wow.
What else did folks notice, or what other questions arose for you as we were charging through this little introduction this evening?
One thing you said that Richard Beck had noticed was about faith or belief or enchantment, whatever we're talking about, and that people were not as impressed by the old tradition, and so they are looking for something new. And immediately I thought of our discussion with CrossFit.
Yeah.
Look at that. Look at those people who are, hello, that's exactly. I hope we need to give them all that book. When they buy their CrossFit,
get the book too. Yeah. There you go. Yeah. So it is. It's exactly directly tied to that. And this is the question that John asked when we were talking about CrossFit was, if all you're in it for is the social club, are we really talking about God here, right? Are we really talking about something theological, or are we just talking about, you know, what gets people's social needs met? And I think the Casper Ter Kuile and Angie Thurston, who study CrossFit as a spiritual community, would say really there's a lot of both. And they would point out that you can see that in the language that people are using. Richard Beck then probably would say in response, I've got them like on our panel discussion, right? So he would probably say in response that it is possible to have a practice of enchantment that is not necessarily Christian and not necessarily, you know, we're not just talking about God here. Richard Beck actually has a whole book on the devil and why we need him. In order for our theology to make sense, in order for our experience of faith to make sense. Partly because of that, partly because you've got the thing on each shoulder, but partly because if everything is only about people, when I get really mad at John for something he said, then it's just all I can be is mad at him. But if I can think about that in slightly more enchanted terms, and I can recognize that that it's not just that, you know, we would all get along except John showed up. It is that that there's a tension and a conflict even between the one who means for us to be reconciled and the one who means for us to be turned against each other. Then I can work things out with John and still be really mad about the thing he said. I don't have to nurse that, right? But I can recognize something went wrong in our relationship, but I don't have to win in order for that thing to get fixed. I think it would be actually really interesting. I want to get this panel discussion together, but to get this conversation about, okay, what is CrossFit noticing? What is missing in what CrossFit is noticing? Casper and Angie, who studied CrossFit as if it were church, also recognized that, hang on a second, these folks are in really deep spiritual waters, right? So you've got, you know, your CrossFit gym is all of a sudden sort of the center of your entire emotional, social, dare I say, spiritual life, or the SoulCycle instructor who somebody texted her on a Sunday evening to ask if they should divorce their spouse, right? And she's like, I'm a fitness instructor. What do I know about this? Well, that's actually like, that's a shape of the ache, right? Like that's an outline of the ache. If I get into community with somebody and they need something that's bigger than me, I'm stuck. If I get into church with somebody in an enchanted relationship and what they need is this connection to this transcendent story, this experience of this transcendent God, we're still in real deep water, but we're not alone in the water. And so part of what Casper and Angie were doing is they're finding ways to connect these leaders of these new communities with the spiritual depth of religious traditions, so that they can actually make sense of what they're trying to do. So that's almost, you know, they're at the place where the enchantment comes up and runs right into you. But they grew up disenchanted. And so they don't have this language from, you know, these rooted religious traditions to fall back on. And that disenchantment, we're going to get this next week, but that disenchantment is the church's fault. So next week we're going to talk about the way that, particularly during the period of Protestantism, So from the Protestant Reformation 504 years ago to today, Protestantism in Western Christianity and the whole sort of Enlightenment European American project has been steadily disenchanting the world. Even though the church was super important, as Warren mentioned, the church is getting less important. And Europe is probably 3 or 4 decades ahead of us on that secularizing process and the church becoming less important socially. A lot of that is because the church quit having something meaningful and enchanted to say. Bev?
When you say church, you're not just saying brick and mortar, you're using it as the organization.
Yeah, so right. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
The church as an institution, but also church as a sort of as a cultural institution. So, you know, the way we talk about the institution of marriage, the institution of religion. Mm-hmm. So as a cultural dynamic, Christianity in particular has gotten much less culturally influential. We are still culturally dominant. I think that's important to say. You know, when the school district gets a random weekday holiday off, and it just happens to line up with Good Friday, there is nobody who can convince me that the West Des Moines schools were off on Friday for any reason other than it was Good Friday. You know, they may have dressed it as professional development, or you know, it's built into the teacher contract or something. It doesn't matter what they call it. It happened on Good Friday, and if it didn't happen on Good Friday, they would have moved it to Good Friday. So, so the church, Christianity, is still culturally dominant, particularly in the United States. But a lot of our stature has changed. And some of that for really good, you know, important reasons that allow for real diversity, and some of that for reasons that are kind of to our discredit, because we've been really interested in telling people what to think and do, and it turns out we haven't been pointing people to God for decades, possibly for centuries, that we have been steadily losing this experiential way of helping people recognize where God is in the world.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.